All right. My name is Viktor Duchovny. I've been working in the space of email security for some time now, since 2001. Some of you know me as a Postfix maintainer. I'm now also on the OpenSSL team, and I've written a few RFCs related to this space. All right. Next slide. So I'm going to talk to you about a few things. The first thing, I'm going to cover a little bit of background for anybody who doesn't know about Dane. Anybody who doesn't know about Dane, you know, I'm going to cover that briefly. I'm going to talk about what to do, even if you're not implementing Dane yourself, but so long as your zone is DNSSEC signed, you're potentially at risk of not receiving email from people who do implement Dane if your DNS lacks the appropriate hygiene. So I'll just cover the issues there. I'm going to talk about how to implement Dane reliably. Some of the enthusiastic early adopters jumped in feet first but haven't really planned how to keep it working properly. So I'm going to help you plan and monitor and automate Dane. And I'm going to talk a little bit about a survey that I'm running which tracks Dane adoption and helps people who accidentally mess up their Dane to correct it by emailing them and all that kind of stuff. And then I have an appendix. I have way too much material to talk about, not enough time. So please find a copy of the slide deck on the website for ICANN for this talk. There are many slides I will whiz through quickly or not cover at all. I have 50-some slides in 45 minutes. It's just not going to happen. All right. So a quick overview of email security. Email is fully secure, right? We have the sender can use authenticated TLS to submit email messages to his mail submission agent, your mail server. And the recipient can read his email securely over TLS authenticated IMAP. And so email is magically secure because both the sender and the recipient are okay, right? Well, there's a little bit of a problem. The mail actually has to get from the sender to the recipient. And so there's this goop in the middle that most users aren't aware of, called MTAs, or mail transfer agents, that move mail around between organizations. And of course, those are secure too. Miraculously, the email just arrives from place A to place B, fully authenticated and encrypted. Well, you know, not exactly. I'm going to describe in a little bit more detail what actually happens in that step two between the sender and the recipient, which is the space where software like Postfix operates and where I've focused my attention on securing. All right. So what actually does happen between organizations when email moves in the background from one user to another? We have something called start TLS or opportunistic start TLS, and that is that mail servers will try and determine whether the destination they're sending mail to support encryption of the email while it's in transit. This technology is quite useful. It resists passive monitoring. If somebody is wiretapping your line but isn't doing anything to interfere with the communications, then your traffic remains confidential while one email server sends to another. But this technology is vulnerable to active attacks. There are a number of papers that you can read that show that these actually take place from time to time and in various places. And the active attacker who's willing to interfere with the traffic can do so via BGP hijacking, causing your traffic to, let's say, go through the Ukraine unexpectedly for a few hours, even if you're communicating between one U.S. organization and another. Or they can do so by doing DNS cache poisoning if DNSSEC isn't in place. Or if they're on path, they can just strip the start TLS advertisement from one mail server to another, and then it'll appear to the sender that the recipient is not capable of encryption, and the email will be sent in the clear. All right. Despite all of that, opportunistic start TLS is an amazing success. Back in 2014, I don't know if you can see on the left, that's when this graph starts. In January 2014, there was about 25% of the traffic that Gmail was seeing was TLS encrypted. I remember even longer ago, it was 5 or 10% when I was postmaster at Morgan Stanley way back. But now, on the right, even though it's a little hard to see how it fits into the scale, about 90% of the email coming and going into Gmail is start TLS encrypted. So this opportunistic TLS stuff is actually working pretty well as intended. And there's a link. You can actually check that periodically and see how the statistics are changing. But we can do better. I'd like to get SMTP to a state where, at least for those people who want it to, we can resist active attacks. We're not vulnerable to the BGP hijacks and the Dinesh gas poisoning and the like. So to do that, while existing in an ecosystem that's largely still on opportunistic, optional start TLS, we need a signal that tells the sender, this recipient can do security. And the signal needs to be downgrade resistant, otherwise the man in the middle will downgrade it and strip that signal just like they do stripping start TLS. And the convenient signal mechanism in this case happens to be DNSSEC. It's by far the most suitable for doing this in email. All right. So one message you should take away is that lots of people like to say, well, you know, SMTP uses TLS. That's just like HTTP. Surely all the things that work well for HTTP will work well in email. Why isn't email more like HTTP? And the answer is radically different. You can read about it at the link off the top of the slide, but mostly the first thing that's radically different is indirection. Email determines where to send mail to based on MX records in DNS. HTTP doesn't do that, and in order for email security to work, you essentially have to trust the content of that MX record. So you're fundamentally relying on DNS already for part of your security. And the other thing is that, in my view at least, the web PKI, the certification authorities, the thousands of them that there are way too many to actually build any kind of secure system, especially because when there is an exception and you maybe don't trust a particular CA, unlike with HTTP where you can click through and say, you know what, I want to view that page anyway. It's not my bank. I don't give a damn. Show me the insecure page. With email, there's no user to say, show me the insecure page. So you kind of have to trust as many CAs as you can lay your hands on, which is not exactly a good security goal. Okay, so in comes Dane. And Dane is very well suited to SMTP. Dane stands for DNS-based authentication of named entities. Quite a mouthful. I wish it were something a little bit simpler. But anyway, in SMTP, the way it's defined in the RFC 76 that Wes Hardacre and I put together is that you indicate that you can receive email securely by publishing a record in DNS. A record in a DNSSEC signed zone. The record that you publish in DNS starts with a port number. For SMTP, it happens to be 25. It continues with the protocol tag, and the SMTP runs over TCP, so we have TCP there. And then it names the MX host for which we're going to do security. And then it lists some parameters that indicate how to secure the traffic. The presence of such a TLSA record for email, as defined by the RFC, says, I will absolutely always do start TLS. If you don't see start TLS from me, there must be an attack or a major operational error, at least in my zone, where I accidentally forgot to enable start TLS, even though I promised to. So this is important. This signal is conveyed over DNSSEC, so it's downgrade resistant. If somebody tries to say, no, there's no such record in the zone, because DNSSEC does authenticated denial of existence, the validating resolver won't believe the attacker that there are no TLSA records. He'll see a failure, and he'll move on to the next MX host. So the first thing is we have a contract to do start TLS. But beyond that, we also have a contract to not only do start TLS, but to in fact have a certificate chain which matches those TLSA records. That's what those public key SHA-256 things are about. I'll talk about those a little bit more in a minute. So Dane authenticates domain control via DNSSEC, so you don't have extraneous CAs, let's encrypt, and perhaps you do trust many others you might not trust. This system is self-contained within the DNS, both for secure publishing of the records and authenticating the peer. And it's downgrade resistant. Okay. So I promised that I would talk a little bit about how to get along with Dane. Domains are starting to implement it. Comcast, I don't know if the gentleman is still here, are doing Dane validation outbound. So if you want to receive email from Comcast, please pay attention here. If you want to receive email from gmx.de or web.de or a number of other organizations, and even ietf.org it now does day invalidation outbound, I believe. They certainly do it inbound, at least. So if you want to coexist with Dane, we need to understand the following. The Dane senders will not talk to MX hosts that for which the TLSA lookup fails. The TLSA lookup can return a valid record. It can prove that the record doesn't exist. Non-existence is not a failure. Failure is that incorrect data is returned. Bad signatures, something wrong about the DNS packet, or expired signatures or things of that sort, or simply not answering at all. If any of those things happen, and especially if they happen across all of your MX hosts, you're not going to receive any email from Dane-enabled senders, whose number, I hope, will continue to increase over the next 2 years. So for domains without TLSA record, if you're not doing Dane yourself, you at the very least need to make sure that the denial of existence of your TLSA records, the fact that they're not there, is delivered reliably. And this Dane is the first protocol for which this is important. Lots of other things have, you know, relied on DNSSEC to protect records that are there and make sure that the records that are there and are delivered are secure. Dane needs records that aren't there to be proved to be correct. And so, not surprisingly, early on, you know, 2014, when I started doing work on Dane, there were lots of name servers that weren't getting this right because nobody cared. Nobody relied on it. Now we do. And over the last few years, I've managed to get most of the operators with the broken name servers to fix it. So it's a largely solved problem, but you need to be aware of it and test your own domain. So the key thing for coexisting with Dane, therefore, is DNSSEC hygiene. You need to make sure that all of the things on this slide, eDNS0, IP fragments, correct responses of no data versus NX domain, and so on, all work for your domain. I'm not going to read every bullet on every slide here. Take that away and test with your domain. Make sure it works correctly. Monitoring is, of course, important. One thing I want to stress is that there have been a number of firewalls, middle boxes, things that think it's a good idea to protect your name server against hostile traffic by blocking queries for certain record types. So if you see a query for an A record or an MX record, that's surely fine. But if you see one of these weird queries for TLSA records, CAA records, CDS records, new DNS record types, surely that's a good thing to block. After all, the zone doesn't have those. So we can just block those queries, right? Well, not such a good idea, because blocking such queries certainly breaks Dane. Your TLSA denial of existence won't work. But also breaks certificate issuance if they're CAA records, or breaks your, potentially someday, your KSK rollovers if you're blocking CDS records and so on. So do not deploy firewalls that block DNS queries by record type. They're a bad idea. They should never have been implemented. But if you have such a firewall, make sure to never turn that feature on. And you can test, I'm showing a couple of examples of with DIG, of queries you should make. And you know they should return either no data or no such domain, not some kind of failure of DNSSEC validation or simply no response. They should not time out and should return what you expect. So here's a DNSSEC checklist. I'm not going to read every detail on it. I throw in some gratuitous bullet points on the end about NSSEC 3 hygiene, which is not really related to Dane, but something that I discovered while running the survey, is that there are some issues with NSSEC 3, and you can read the links and learn more about NSSEC 3 hygiene. Here's a picture with DNSViz of one site that Dane-enabled domains won't be able to send mail to. TechDirect.gov consistently, after signing their zone, does something to bump up the serial number after the SOA is signed. So the SOA record never validates, and so the denial of existence never works. And you could actually, if you write some code, I wrote a Perl script that kind of reverse engineered their signatures and figured out that they're exactly off by one. If I roll their SOA serial number back by one, their signature validates. But they're always one higher than what it should be. Don't do that! So be careful about, but if they monitored, they would have noticed such a thing. All right, so that was DNSSEC hygiene. You know, do practice it even if you're not doing Dane. Okay, now I'm going to talk, oh, by the way, there are more slides with examples of DNSSEC bad hygiene in the appendix if you're curious. Adopting Dane. So let's suppose that you're very excited, like I am, and you want to adopt Dane. So the first thing is, you're not going to get very far without DNSSEC. You'll need to sign your zone. So once you've signed your zone, that's the hard part. Managing DNSSEC is harder than managing DANE. Managing DANE, I believe you'll be, believe me, by the end of this talk, is easy. The tricky part that I will show you how to do correctly is coordinating your TLSA records in your certificate chain. DANE requires, in principle, that you make changes when you rotate your keys for your TLS SMTP server in two places. One is you need to deploy your certificates in your private keys, and the other is that you might need to update your TLSA records in DNS. And juggling these two sets of related changes looks hard, but let's make it easy. Okay. So the first thing, though, is I will talk about outbound DANE. Suppose you're not ready to sign your zone or haven't figured out operationally yet or trained your team how to do the TLSA record maintenance. You can still enable DANE for checking mail that you're sending to sites that have implemented DANE. For this, you just need a DNSSEC validating resolver. Ideally, one that runs right on the mail server. Mail servers are perfectly capable machines. They're not laptops. They're not phones. They're machines in data centers that can run a local resolver. Having one improves your performance and also lets you leverage it for the validation. And many of the MTAs that are implementing DANE don't do DNSSEC validation themselves. They just rely on their local resolver to tell them whether the record is validated or not. So you want to have a secure path to it, nothing more secure than running on the same machine and just speaking to the loopback interface. So the DANE-enabled MTAs that you can easily get off the shelf are PostFix, XSIM, CloudMark has an offering to providers that sort of scales larger than these smaller MTAs like PostFix and XSIM. And there are more coming. I'm aware of some. I don't know that I should specifically mention people who haven't released yet, but I know that various other vendors are working on this. And then once you have such an MTA that can do DANE, you have a local validating resolver, look up the documentation, turn it on. It largely works. Just like with Comcast and their negative trust anchors, there are occasionally needs to do negative DANE anchors, domains that you want to exclude because they mess up. There's a GitHub page which somebody volunteered to maintain of a partial list of domains with DANE failures that they are finding. I occasionally contribute to it. Feel free to contribute to it if you also find other domains that can be validated to be broken. There's not that many, but you can have an exception list from time to time. Okay, so the focus of the talk is really inbound DANE. So how do you implement and manage TLSA records? Well, the first thing is, you're not going to get very far unless your MTA supports StarTLS. So definitely make sure that your MTA supports StarTLS reliably. Then you need your MX records to be DNSSEC signed. If the indirection from your domain to whoever it is that manages its email is insecure, then the man in the middle can redirect your email to some MX host of their choice, and you're not going to get mail security unless your own domain is signed. But then it gets a little bit more interesting, because once your MX record is signed, if your email is hosted by some provider who's not you and they're operating your mail servers for you, then you're done. It's up to the provider now to implement the rest of the DANE inbound story. The TLSA records belong with the MX host, not with the hosted domain. So if you're a customer of a hosting provider who manages a lot of domains, your job is easy. You just get your domain signed. And managing all the mail stuff and the certificate rotation, all of the security bits are done by the outsourced provider. On the other hand, if you're managing your own mail hosts, then you're essentially your own provider. And so the rest of this talk will talk about how to be a provider. So the provider gets to publish one of two kinds of TLSA records. The specification defines 24 different types of TLSA records. 22 of them are a bad idea. Don't use those. There are only two that you should ever think remotely consider publishing. The first one, 311, has a certificate usage called DANE-EE. The E stands for end entity, it really meaning the server. You're publishing the SHA-256 digest of the public key in the server certificate. It's a kind of a pin. You're committing that my server will have a particular public key. The alternative is that you can say, I'm not sure what certificates my server will necessarily have, but but I'm sure it'll be issued by a particular certification authority, particular trust anchor. And so I'm publishing the SHA-256 hash off the public key of whoever it is that's going to issue my server certificates. Of course, you can publish both, and we'll see, in fact, there's a good use case for publishing both. So the TLC record has either a 211 or a 311, or it has something else if you're not listening to me and you're doing the wrong thing. So the rest of the record is a hash value. This is where you get to say what, in fact, is the digest of your public key. So for IETF.org, at the bottom of the slide, you'll see that their hash starts with OC72 and ends with 0C72, ends with D3D6, at least last time I looked. Maybe they've rotated it in the meantime. Okay, so how do we manage TLSA records? The thing that you have to do is to get your TLSA record into the DNS before the certificate chain is deployed. The DNS has extensive caching. There's caching between the resolver and the authoritative servers, and even between authoritative servers, there's caching between slave servers and the master zone in many cases. And so there's a significant lag between when you make your changes in the authoritative server, updating your TLSA records, and when clients start to see those rather than whatever you had before. And therefore, the TLSA records that say, I have such and such a certificate, have to be in place for some time before the certificate is actually activated on the mail server, so that by the time it's activated, the clients who are going to see that certificate will look at the TLSA record, they'll see an appropriately recent one, and say, aha, this server certificate is good. So, but fortunately, we don't have an impossible problem of exactly synchronizing the updates to the TLSA record and the certificate. Impossible because of DNS caching. We can publish multiple TLSA records, some that work now and some that will work in the future. And the verifier who's consuming the TLSA records doesn't have to have every TLSA record match. It suffices for just one TLSA record to match the certificate chain. So what we do is we publish keys well in advance, and we make sure that always at least one of the TLSA records will match either the present or the soon-to-be-present key. There are two ways to do this. The one I really recommend is the first one, where you publish two TLSA records, both of them end entity, both of them match the server public key, one matching the current public key and the other one matching the next public key that you're going to have next time you roll your certificate. And the other model that I can recommend is that you publish two keys, one for your server and the other for the issuing CA. And I'll explain what the advantages of each model are. So let's go. So current plus next, this is both matching the server public key, one now, one in the future. So what do you do to make this to stay sane while doing this? So let's say you want to rotate your keys, hypothetically, every 90 days. But you don't want to have to make lots and lots of coordinated sequenced steps so that you have to, you know, three or four times during that 90 days remember to do something and then wait for it to finish and then do the next thing and so on. You just want to have one change cycle every 90 days. In order to keep it simple, you generate the next key on the same day that you deploy the current key. So let's suppose this is day zero. I've deployed the current key, but I also generate the key that I'm going to use 90 days from now. I can squirrel away the private key, keep it offline, whatever. So long as I can get my hands on the public key value, I can immediately deploy both the new certificate chain with the new key and publish a TLSA record that will match the key I'm going to have 90 days from now. So in the slide, you see two TLSA records, both 311. One matches the current public key I just turned on, and the other one matches the public key I'm going to have 90 days from now. Then weeks, months, whatever, years later, I encourage you to do it more often rather than less, because it's easier to debug operational processes that happen quickly, that happen frequently, rather than things you only do once every 3 to 5 years or something. You're never going to figure out how you're doing it right or wrong. So whatever time, when it comes time to the next maintenance window, you obtain a certificate for the pre-generated key. And this is easy. The keys, you know, you just sign a CSR. You can, in fact, have signed the CSR, you know, the 90 days ago time. And then just go to your CA, obtain a new certificate. But before you even think of obtaining the certificate, and deploying it, make sure the TLSA record matching the key you're going to use is already in place. It should have been in place for a long time. And this check will keep you out of trouble. You are never going to deploy a certificate whose TLSA record isn't already there and hasn't been there for a long time already. And then once you do that, you've deployed the new certificate, and you again go back to the first step, generate the next key again. And with this kind of process, you can make sure that you're not scrambling at the last minute to update your DNS with new TLSA records because you got yourself a new certificate chain. So this works well. And it can work even with Let's Encrypt, who automate your key rollover for you, and certificate generation, if you use the CSR option, which allows you to specify your own key rather than have them generate one for you. Okay. So that was the first model. The second model is one where instead of having the current key for the server and the next key for the server, you have the current key for the server and the current key for your CA. In this model, we publish both, and if either of them verifies, you're good. And then when it's time to do a rollover, so long as the CA stays the same, it's okay if you deploy a new server certificate with a new key that doesn't match the 311 record. Your 211 record will continue to work because it's still the same CA. And then you deploy it, you test it, you make sure that the 211 record works correctly. The 311 record will not match, but once you're happy with the certificate and everything is fine, you can then rotate the 311 record after deploying the certificate. In other words, if you don't like planning ahead and you like to be reactive and deploy stuff and then make changes that correspond to it, this model allows you to be a procrastinator and deploy a certificate at the last minute and then update the 311 record. On the other hand, if at some point your CA decides to use a new certificate and a new public key, then, and only then, you would make sure that you obtain from the new CA, and their new public key, a certificate with the same key you were using before. So again, you maintain continuity. The 211 record will change, but the 311 will stay the same. And so you can leapfrog, periodically rotating 211, keeping 311 the same, or periodically keeping 211 the same and changing the 311. And so long as you're disciplined about this, again, the process is fairly simple. So that's that. Of course, any process you're going to do frequently is subject to human error if people are reading a sort of a script of steps they have to manually perform. As much as possible, if you're going to implement Dane, especially if you're a service provider, you don't want to have your team doing this by hand. You really should have some automation in place for doing this. Unfortunately, I can't tell you how to do the certificate deployment because, you know, how they're stored and how they're deployed depends on the MTA. And I can't tell you how to do the DNS updates because, unfortunately, different authoritative server backends have different mechanisms for inserting data. NS update, maybe, and we're trying to put together some scripts. I might post about that at some point. But unfortunately, the automation will continue to be somewhat site-dependent for a while. If you are deploying TLSA records in Dane, please have working contacts in Whois or in the responsible email address in your SOA record, or at least a working postmaster address. Occasionally, other people will be unable to send you mail, and they'll want to contact you and let you know this. And I've struggled occasionally with finding working contacts for people who make mistakes. Monitor your Dane. I'm currently monitoring it, but I'm not the world's monitoring system forever. So please do monitor your own deployment. Make sure that it's working correctly. So here's a list of best practices for Dane. Don't use wildcard certs. Don't roll all of your MX hosts at the same time. All kinds of good stuff like that. All right. Okay, so that was how to deploy Dane. There are some Dane software, as I mentioned, PostFix, XM, CloudMark. If you're running your own site for your own personal domain, I can very strongly recommend mailinabox.email. They give you a turnkey appliance that does the DNSSEC and the Dane and the certificate rollover with Let's Encrypt. It's fully integrated. You just turn it on, delegate it, you know, box.example.com to it if you own example.com. And it just takes care of all the details, including anti-spam and, you know, antivirus, and, you know, it's excellent software. If you're a developer, you can use OpenSSL 1.1.0, to which I contributed the Dane validation library, and there's some documentation that you can read about how to do that. If you want to use GNU TLS, you can do it, but there are some caveats, so I don't strongly recommend it. Get in touch with me if you want to develop something that does Dane over GNU TLS. There are some warts. If you maintain or are planning to write Dane-related software, get in touch. We can exchange ideas, comments, that sort of thing. Here's a list of Dane tools. There's a site where you can test your own domain on the web. There's a user list to which I post monthly statistics. Paul Wooters wrote this Hashlinger thing that lets you generate your TLSA records and check them. Phil Pennock of XM development team wrote something called SMTP Dane in Go. That's a validator that you can use to test your domain. I wrote one in Haskell, and everybody's afraid of Haskell, so probably nobody will use mine. Or you can even do it yourself with a shell script. I have an example in the appendix of how to use the OpenSSLS client command to test your MTA's correctness of the TLSA records. Okay, and now I have about 2 minutes to cover my survey, so I'm doing okay. So I operate a survey that scans as many DNSSEC domains as I can lay my hands on. I pull in about 200 million domains worth, and off those, 5 million or so are currently DNSSEC signed. And interestingly enough, 180,000 or so domains do actually Dane SMTP, and they cover millions of users, Comcast, GMX, et cetera. And here's some numbers on MX hosts, and there's a small percentage of people with problems, 100 or so domains with the DNS hygiene problems, around 150 with wrong TLSA records. All my attempts to notify them of trouble have not yet succeeded. This is growth over time. If we go back to 2016, we had about 1,800 different organizations with Dane TLSA MX hosts. Now we have around 3,200. So it continues to grow fairly steadily. Okay. Here are some domains. Registro.br, who spoke to us. Comcast is on there. GMX is on there. Domena Shop has a very large deployment. And some obvious .orgs like ITF.org and security-minded things like TorProject.org and so on have Dane. There are, of course, a lot more, but these are prominent ones. This is something I want to as an appeal. These are providers who host a very large number of DNSSEC signed domains and host the mail host for them. But the mail host does not have DNSSEC or has DNSSEC but doesn't have Dane. The world would be a much better place if these particular providers, and if you are one of these providers or you know people there who you can influence and twist their arm. So OVH.net has 1.4 million MX records point at them. They're signed, but OVH's MX host isn't. One.com, similarly, a very large population of domains that they host mail for that could go live with Dane but haven't yet. Interestingly enough, Google is slowly moving from Google.com to GoogleMail.com, and I understand that doing DNSSEC for Google.com is a very big and hairy problem, but doing DNSSEC for GoogleMail.com should be easier. So I'm becoming a little bit optimistic that maybe the 335,000 domains hosted by GoogleMail.com will at some point over the next year or two, maybe, if all goes well and they get excited about this, go to Dane. And there are various other providers who I'd like to see implement Dane. So I'd like some help. Certainly, I'd like to be able to monitor more of the internet, so if any ccTLDs are willing to share data with zone data with me on a research basis, I'll sign whatever NDAs you want to throw at me, but I'd like to have more data. I'd like people to remediate the remaining name servers, the 100 or so, that still don't do denial of existence correctly or simply block TLSA lookups. Please enable Dane outbound, especially if you're a very large sender, because the people who screw up their TLSA records will notice that they're doing it. If there's pressure from large providers, all of a sudden not sending them mail, then they'll quickly notice the problem and I won't have to be the one notifying them. Please enable DNSSEC and Dane, as I mentioned, if you're OVH or One.com or any one of these large providers, go ahead and do that. And of course, finally, I'd like to appeal to people like GoDaddy, who has, last I heard, about 37 million or more domains that they host, both the DNS and mail and so on. Very little of that is signed. Certainly there's no TLSA records there yet, but it would be a fantastic step forward if GoDaddy were willing to work with me to get Dane done for the tens of millions of domains that they have. Appendix. I'm not talking about the appendix. Yes. Any questions, or am I out of time for that too?